This is Andrew Clover, and today I'm making up a fairy story with the wild genius, actor-playwright Stephen Berkoff.
So how are you at the moment?
I'm doing a lot of writing at the moment. A couple of things fell through. Hmm. Theatre is often to do with elitism, esoteric subjects, actresses taking off their clothes and doing it for art. I get a sense of a few precious farts, loving the smell of their own stink, excluding you if you don't fit into the kind of the stink horizon, which I don't.
I'm really very keen on your work for quite a few different reasons. One is I love your plays. There was East, there was Greek, Kvetch, and there was Decadence. There should be the Berkoff Evening at the National. What's happened? How come you're available to be interviewed by us this morning?
I'm unemployed. But Nietzsche said he'd rather breathe the thinner air of the mountain peaks than be amongst the dross. So maybe it's good or not, I'm not amongst the dross.
Yeah.
And maybe it's good that sometimes it's harder for me to get the shows on.
Kvetch.
I was supposed to direct Al Pacino on Broadway.
No.
He said, I've fallen in love with his play. I want to play Herod. I say, yeah, but, you know, forgive me, but I still want to do it myself. And I could have done that, and I might have changed my whole career around. And then a year or two later, he did it himself. He had this bum director, and of course the production stank like a kind of rotting jam rag on a summer's day in a dustbin in Petticoat Lane. Yeah. I did put in for a directorship of the National after the Nun left.
Yeah. So if you were in control of the National, what would you have?
I would certainly have my own work there on an epic scale, and I would probably invite geniuses, radical inventors. They say that God created man in his own image. So whoever runs these institutions creates a theatre in their own hideous, ugly, moronic, dopey, self-satisfied and smug image. I saw a production and I thought it was hideous. Shakespeare emphasises his adoration of language and his abhorrence of clutter. When we talk of horses, you see them printing their proud hoofs to the receiving earth, for 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our stages. So on the stage comes a bloody truck. A truck in a modern version, you know, and guns. And I had never seen anything so utterly abhorrent in my life. So I came home and I got a big double margarita. Oh, my God, it was so awful. I was like, I felt physically ill.
And did the margarita wash out the toxins?
It helped.
The awfulness?
It helped. It helped to coruscate all that foulness. It just burned it out of me.
Yeah. I find that when I go around to people's houses and they've got on Big Brother there on the television, I can just feel like this kind of plastic lump in my mind and it starts to dull you. Slowly, the desire to create gets trapped inwards and then you just get sad. I want to begin a story in a second. But first, I want to ask about when you were about 18, or the point at which, before you began your life in the theatre and film and writing, where were you living at that point?
I was at home at Manor House.
What were the things you were fearing or thinking you would never achieve?
Well, you know, like all your teenagers, we're searching for something. And you're not on the track, then you're wandering around the forest and perhaps taking a route which had not been seen before.
Let's begin in a forest.
And yeah, in the forest, because you're forest. Fighting through the forest. Like Richard III, you're in the forest.
That's
you know?
Right. So
and
the
when Richard said, dense. What does Richard say? He says, I like one lost in a thorny wood that threatens the thorns and is rent with the thorns, seeking a way and straying from the way. Torment myself to find the open air, and from that torment I will free myself or hew my way out with a bloody axe. Why, I can smile and murder as I smile.
So he's fighting his way out with a bloody axe. And in fact, what he does is he comes to a clearing. And in that clearing, there is a cart, but the cart does not have any horses.
No.
And the first thing you do is you summon a spell to create those horses. There's something that you say.
Excuse me, waiter!
And instantly, a waiter comes out of the undergrowth, possibly slightly splattered by the blood, and he brings two horses.
Giovanni, the very, very elegant waiter, extraordinarily thin. A moustache that reminds me of Salvador Dali, but he's an absolute elegant man, but has an unfortunate habit of picking his nose.
Giovanni is there, elegant, with a huge moustache, picking his nose, and you are slightly disgusted, but still slightly seduced. And he gives you what appears to be his bogey. And you sort of crush it in your right hand, and then you open your right hand, and I'm shocked to discover there's actually some words. How many words are there?
Two.
What do they say?
Phone home.
And you get up onto the cart, and instantly, out of the wooden panelling, comes a phone. And you dial up.
Calling my mum.
Yes. How old are you in this story?
About 50.
Yeah. When you were 50, was she alive
no.
then? So you're calling your mother beyond the grave.
Oh, yes.
What does she say?
I've got a bagel toasting in the oven. If you don't get home, it's going to be burnt.
That's the thing I remember from my mother. She had this kind of reverence for the bagel. As soon as she had put her hands in the bagel, she relaxed. Her eyes kind of watered a bit, and then she'd cut it, and then she'd spread some cream cheese on it, and then a little thin sliver of salmon.
You're there on that cart and you're heading off. And it's not just to see your mother's bagel. Suddenly there's something that you're desperate to show her. So you've gone through the forest in that cart.
I'm crossing great ravines and huge cliffs and marvellous defiles and really fast white water streams. It's necessary to navigate over these streams as well. And so I'm cutting through the forest. I chop down maybe half a dozen great trees and I strap them together, put my coach and horse on that, and I'm put in mind of Aguirre, Wrath of God, and I'm thinking, my God, this is so close to Klaus Kinski's film.
That's right, you're on a cart going down the river with massive log, but suddenly there's something in the path of the river.
There is this gigantic wall. I don't want to make too much analysis now. More the monkeys have come out of the forest. You see, when Klaus Kinski was there with his director, they made friends with the monkeys.
Yes.
I'm there. They thought I was a film crew.
They actually want to be in the movies.
Well, they have a certain vanity. There was a wonderful monkey that crawled over Klaus Kinski, and he threw it away like that. And the monkey complained. He needed extra special money for that. He was thrown, you know. There was a court case where new laws are made protecting screen artists and monkeys. Mm. It's called the monkey law.
Well, that's probably the very monkey that is following us.
It might have done, yes.
That feels it has already worked with Kinski. Burkhoff is not such a great hero to the monkey. And he's a little bit uppity because he's broken his leg.
Well, his leg was much better, but he's on the mobile even when I was speaking to him.
But he could be helpful because what you've got to do is to get through that huge wall or above it.
You've leapt ahead of me.
Yes.
You have run before my cart to market.
And how will you cast yourself upon this wall? How will you breach it? Will there be a tunnel that goes like a mole underneath the cliff, or will you somehow ride upon it? Tell me, Burkhoff.
Well, you see, at the moment I'm studying it.
Ah.
I can see it's Herodian.
Ah.
Built at least 2,000 years ago. Have I suddenly come across the Western Wall, or part of the Jerusalem Wall that surrounds the old temple built by Herod? Yes, indeed. So this trip has taken me a very interesting route.
Hmm.
As they say in America.
You've taken yourself 2,000 years back in time. That is a movie that I can work on, and I'm particularly into the fact that you will eventually be meeting your mother. That, for me, gives it a kind of grace, a kind of dignity. Hey, really, I'm buying. Break off, carry on.
Well, you know, when I got to the wall, and I thought, oh, my God, I wish Al Pacino was with me here because he'd really have a lot of fun.
And you turn around and instantly, of course, that monkey, who else was it but Pacino in one of his great roles?
Well, it could be Pacino. And I think this monkey was doing an impersonation of Pacino.
Possibly hey. Pacino has been doing an impersonation of Klinsky's monkey all of his career.
So I was very hesitant to say to the monkey, hey, Al, you know, you do a great impersonation of a monkey in case it still was the monkey. Should I address him and suddenly become genuflecting and crawling as Al, or kick him out as the monkey?
Yeah.
So I was caught in a kind of a schizophrenic dilemma.
Where you kind of both kicked him and bowed at once. A kind of bow, and you whacked Pacino on the head.
So we were there just looking at each other, and the stream was the beating against the wall, and the wall was there, and the sun was glinting against the wall, and the monkey was, you know, clinging to me.
Because in fact, on the wall, you can see words
written in great yellow paint.
Ah. And what do they say?
McDonald's.
Perfect.
Yes.
It is a McDonald's in a 2,000-year-old Herodian wall.
It could be a time slip.
A time slip which allows us to be in two times at once.
And so that's what's happened. I've got the image of McDonald against the great temple. And the wall says, no Gentiles allowed. Goyim, keep out.
Yes.
Because otherwise, death. This is for Jews only.
Yes.
Piss off.
Yes. You can go in, but Pacino, the monkey, and indeed that slightly effete Italian waiter, these are not Jews. No, these are not the chosen
they
people.
They can't go in. I am going in, because I can go in, and they say, are you Jewish? I say, of course I'm Jewish. What do you mean? My mother's got a bagel. He's it. Oh, I can tell you're Jewish. Okay. They throw me a little skull cap that I put on, and then they open the door, and I'm inside, and I see all the people praying. So how's Monty? So what's he going to be when he grows up? Oh, he's going to be a doctor. Doctor, how much going to make? Maybe $50,000, $100,000. Oh, that's good. And how's Moshe? Moshe, bless him, he's a sweet boy. He's going to be a rabbi. So how much does a rabbi make? He says he makes maybe $20,000 a year. Only $20,000, that's a job for a Jewish boy. So I see all my friends, Auntie Betty, Uncle Sam, hey, how are you doing? Hello, Steve. Are you working? No, not working. Why aren't you working? You should get a job. So a dream becomes an extraordinary nightmare, a terrible nightmare of paranoia, where I see all my relatives all saying, why aren't you working? Why can't you get a job? You could get a job in EastEnders. So suddenly I'm caught. I'm in this place. I can't breathe. All my relatives, and they're all fat, and they're all shouting at me. And I think, oh, my God, what? I must get out. I said, I'm an actor. I'm an artist. I have left the ghetto. I have left the East End. You know, I can quote Shakespeare. So I find myself running. I've got to get to Mum. Get out the other side. Open the door. I'm suddenly running down the street, and then suddenly, oh, I see Manor House. I'm in by the flats. I press the button. The lift door opens, a metal door. I go inside. It smells so reassuring of piss. As I go up to the 8th floor, press the bell. Bing dong! And there she opens the door. Hello, Ma. You're just in time. I got a nice bagel roasting in the oven and also some fish cakes. Oh, fish cakes. I love the fish cakes. I love the fish cakes. Thanks, Ma. So Steve, are you working?
What was it that you were going to tell me at the beginning of the story that you wanted to show your mother?
Actually, I never had anything to show her except myself.
Ah.
I'd tell her that I'm doing my first production. And she'd come to see it and sit there and very often say to a neighbour, you know,
that's my son!
She was so bursting with pride. And as she watched the people laughing or clapping, she could not say that's not to do with her.
So in fact, you were giving her exactly what she wanted, which was your own success. Receiving from her exactly what she wanted to give, which was food. If you were to remember now some piece of advice that you, Berkoff, now would give to the 18-year-old who wished to start out, but it might actually be a quotation from Salome.
What, using a quote from Oscar Wilde?
Yeah.
When he says to Salome, he says, dance for me, Salome. Dance. Dance through your parts. If you get on the stage and you see an armchair, burn it. If you see a drinks table, smash it. If you see a set, kick it out.
And the 18-year-old, yes, Berkoff, listens to this advice. Yes. But what happens if, having kicked all the chairs, having burned all the sets, I find I am left on my own? What will happen then, older Berkoff? What will happen then?
When she dances, he says to her, I will give thee jewels your mother even has never seen. Give jewels, make your work beautiful, dance it, and make your words like jewels.
And it doesn't matter if you are halfway up the mountain or on the top of the mountain in the thin mountain air surrounded by nobody but clouds. The message is the same. Give jewels.
Give jewels.
Story Man.